This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It isn't just businesses that close out their books at the end of the year. You should be doing the same thing, particularly if you have investments. It's time to take stock to perhaps realize some losses to offset the gains you may have had in 2014. It's also time to rebalance your portfolio, whether you have several $1 million or just a small 401k. And for help with that, we've invited Larry Carroll of Carroll Financial Associates, one of the nation's best financial planners, to join us. That's not my opinion, but that of Worth Magazine, where he's been on their list of the nation's most exclusive wealth managers 12 times. And of Barron's, where his name has appeared on all of their annual lists of the top 100 independent financial advisors. Larry Carroll, welcome back.
Good morning, Mike. Nice. Hope you're well.
Well, I'm well, yes.
Yeah, good.
Aside from a couple of scares this year in the stock market, hasn't it been a pretty good year?
Oh, it's been a real good year. I think certainly better than most of us expected. Market's up probably 13% at this point. And you know, we were expecting high single-digit returns, 6 to 9 type number, and we're ahead of that. And it's particularly good because we're coming off such a great year in 2013 and didn't give it back. We continued to move up. So it's been a very good year.
Why didn't you expect it to be a good year?
Well, mostly because we look at the price earnings multiple. Stock prices are determined by how much the company earns and then what multiple the market puts on it. The market was at about 15 or 16 times earnings at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. It's actually moved up to between 16 and 17 times earnings at this point. So it's putting a little higher multiple on it.
Is that a fair number? Is that a good number? Is it an accurate number?
Great question. Long-term average is about 16.
Okay.
So we were just below the long-term average. Now we're probably just above the long-term average. I think the important part of that equation, though, is that earnings came through very well. Companies continue to make money and increase their earnings. Now, in a lot of cases, and I think this is interesting, in a lot of cases that growth in earnings is not coming from a lot more revenue. It's coming from cost cutting, but it still falls to the bottom line. But you got to keep in mind that you can only cost cut so far.
Yes, and jobs are coming back. That's usually where they cut.
That's correct.
The cost,
so we may be kind of turning the corner on their ability to right. cut cost, and from here we need to see revenues go up and earnings continue.
Because some people were speculating that there is no reason for the stock market to do as well as it has done in the last several years, except for the fact that there's no other place to put money if you want any kind of return. So all the money's going in, which is raising up prices.
It is a factor in the process, and I would be concerned about that at a point where the market, let's say, is at 18 or more times earnings. As long as we're around that 16, the long-term average multiple, the fact of that's how it got there doesn't overly concern me. But that could lead to overvaluation, which you would have if we were up another 10 to 15% from here.
So 2014 has been a good year. We seem to be in recovery, full recovery. Jobs are the job situation is healthier than it's been since 2008. Is there any reason to believe that this will not continue next year?
I don't think so. Now, again, we would expect high single-digit returns next year, 6 to 9%. But as you alluded to, that's still better than you get anywhere else at this point in time in the cycle. We have to watch and make sure that these earnings continue to grow as they have. But the thing I would add to that conversation is I think we can have more confidence in the idea of earnings continuing to grow because of oil prices being down so much. You have to think of it in terms of when the price of gas at the pump goes down, the average individual on the street gets a raise in terms of their available cash flow. Mm-hmm. To do things with. And that, for the most part, most people are going to spend it. So it gets cycled or recycled back into the economy. And because of this decline in oil prices, I have more confidence in next year being a good year than I might have.
And you think
otherwise.
That will continue to be either prices will continue to go down or they'll stay where they are now, not go back up?
I do.
Wow.
I just think we have an awful lot of oil continuing to be found in the United States and other places, but mostly in the U.S., and to come onto the market. And at the same time that you've got this additional supply, you also have demand that's moderating some, meaning that a lot of the world economies are not growing as fast as they have in the past. So the oil utilization or demand is not as big from a growth perspective as it has been. The other thing that I think is overlooked in the discussion is we've been putting more and more fuel-efficient cars out there for a long time, and so a bigger percentage of the total cars in use are more efficient today than they were 10 or 15 years ago.
Of course, there's a downside to lower fuel prices, and not just for people who hold stock in Exxon. The people are losing jobs. The growth in places like North Dakota, where they've been fracking and pumping oil, are drifting away. These are high-paying jobs, not just people in the oil fields, but people working at McDonald's.
Minimum wage at McDonald's in South Dakota is $18 an hour.
Yeah, amazing. So there's a downside to this, too. Will that
Absolutely
downside
right.
be felt elsewhere in the stock market?
It's a great question. We think that when you look at the oil issue in total, that it's about 80% positive and 20% negative.
Okay.
It's negative for those pockets that you mentioned that are really oil-based economies. But in terms of the general population, which is much bigger than those smaller pockets, it is a positive. So we think it's a net positive. I think that we have reduced our exposure to oil stocks some.
We being your clients.
We being, yes, dealing with our clients, we have. And reduced our exposure to some of the kind of ancillary businesses that tie in. For example, the MLPs, that Master Limited Partnerships, that are the oil pipelines. We still own some, but we own less than we have in the past. We just think that there's a lot of change going on in that industry. I would be slow to move in terms of trying to pick the winners and to take advantage of these changes. It's going to take a while for this to sort itself out.
What effect, if any, will the Republican takeover of both houses of Congress have perhaps on the investment environment, on taxes, on the investment environment?
Yeah. You know, my gut says it's a pretty big non-event from an investment and a tax perspective. I do think we'll get a lot more discussions, but I can't assume that we get compromise and real action out of it at this point.
Because there were spending agreements reached in the wake of the 2013 government shutdown that will expire in September of 2015. Could we see another government shutdown, or will the Republican control of both houses allow them to reach some sort of consensus and avoid that?
I think you will see discussion of it. I don't think you will see the government shutdown. And I think that both parties have kind of agreed to that at this point, although both parties will have minority factions that don't want it to be that smooth and easy.
And there were tax provisions. I'm not sure what these are, but I read yesterday there are tax provisions that expired at the end of last year. Will the return of the GOP-controlled Congress return these tax provisions to the taxpayer?
Well, they already have for this year within the past few days. What happens is there's some provisions like being able to take money from your IRA and contribute it directly to charity out of your IRA that keep getting extended for 1 year. And we've done this for 4 or 5 years now at least, and almost every time it's in December before they go ahead and renew them again. It's a pretty big game. They really need to go in and put these things in place on a permanent basis.
Who takes advantage of that? It would seem to me if you're going to give money to charity out of your retirement account, you don't need that money. You're wealthy.
Well, that could be true. One situation where it comes into play is people that make large contributions over periods of time. Mm-hmm. And let's say on your individual tax return, you can have charitable giving carry forwards where you haven't been able to deduct them all. Let's say you have low taxable income and you make a $100,000 contribution. You may not be able to deduct it all. So you carry forward that charitable deduction. Mm-hmm. By making the contribution to charity out of your IRA, you don't add to your carry forwards. You're able to basically give the entire, let's say, $100,000 out of the IRA.
And write it off.
Well, you don't deduct it, remember that this money's never been taxed before.
I see.
So it will never come out and be taxed because it came out of the IRA to the charitable institution.
And why is something like that, which is probably not used by a lot of people?
It is not used by a lot of people.
Why is something like that given a year-by-year reprieve?
Charities like it.
the charity lobby.
That's right. And they love going to their donors and saying, you can do this.
Okay.
But for the vast majority of the people, they could take the money out of the IRA, make the contribution, deduct the contribution, and they end up at the same place. So it's not as big an issue as it seems on the surface. And as you say, it's a small group of people that it affects. But they just need to provide more clarity in terms of the tax law, meaning that you can either do this or you can't. Not that we're trying to figure it out the first week of December every year, whether you can do it or not.
Any tax or investor implications that you see of a possible repeal or major alteration of the Affordable Care Act? Because the Affordable Care Act seems to me to be benefiting insurance companies greatly.
Some, and there are some individuals who are certainly benefiting from it. I have a hard time seeing, I don't think legally they can repeal it. They certainly can alter it. But I don't think they're going to go in and kind of all at one time totally rewrite this thing and totally redo it. I think they'll make smaller revisions over time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any great investment implications of that.
Not even in healthcare services?
Well, I mean, yeah. It's an order of magnitude question.
Okay.
Sure, they could change some of that, but I don't think it's going to totally change the game or the playing field for those people.
I want to talk about the bond market because people have been saying don't buy bonds for so long because they're not doing anything, they're not performing well. But I know you want to talk about a surprise from the bond market, and we'll do that when we come back because we're looming large toward a break. So why launch into a conversation about something we can't even get the first sentence out about? Larry Carroll's with us. He's the president and chief wealth strategist at Carroll Financial Associates, which happens to be the largest independent financial advisory firm in this area. We're coming right back with more, and we'll talk about how to get your personal investments ready for the end of the year and for tax season. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sharon Luggage, a Charlotte destination offering luggage from Briggs & Riley, Tumi, Victorinox, and Rimowa, providing personalized gifts, travel accessories, and briefcases. Details at SharonLuggage.com. And Foundation for the Carolinas offering planned giving services and helping individuals leverage assets such as stock, real property, and business interests to support their charitable goals. Information available at fftc.org. Geraldine Lucas is a journalist and a TV producer who 20 years ago added breast cancer advocate to her resume. She wrote a book about her diagnosis and subsequent fight to survive called Why I Wore Lipstick to My Mastectomy, which was later made into a movie. Now she has another book, a kind of sequel, called Then Came Life, which addresses life after survival, including the fear of return of the cancer. She shares her story with us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Senate Democrats' detailed report on post-9/11 CIA interrogation and detention practices, debate over what useful intelligence, if any, was gathered, and security risks abroad related to the report's release.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here with Larry Carroll, President and CEO of Carroll Financial Associates, talking about the stock market, the bond market, and how to get your portfolio and your retirement portfolio and you just get your financial house in order for the end of the year and the beginning of 2015. The bond market. Bond market, pretty dismal.
Yeah, and you know... Everybody's been scared of the bond market, as you alluded to, for 4 or 5 years now under the assumption that rates have to go up. Well, for 2014, rates actually went down again.
Right.
On the 10-year Treasury, you've gone from 3% to a little under 2.4 right now, I think. So the bond market provides a return that's in the 5 or 6% range for the year. Now, we all think that sooner or later it has to be a bad place to be when rates turn and go up. But the question becomes, when do rates turn and go up? And we don't think it happens very quickly from here. One of the really interesting things that people overlook in this bond market discussion is they look at how low our interest rates are. For example, the 2.4% on a 10-year government bond. It's lower most other places in the world. In Europe, it's less than 1% for that 10-year bond. So what's happening is a lot of money from Europe and other places, including Japan, are coming to the U.S. and buying our bonds because they think the 2.4% is attractive compared to their other alternatives. So there is demand for bonds, even at these rates. I still think you have to be careful. We would certainly limit our exposure to interest rate risk in the bond market, but it has continued to surprise over time.
What about international markets? You mentioned the bond rates being lower in other parts of the world. Europe, they're essentially still in recession, right? China, what about China?
Yeah. Now, what I want to look back at the U.S. market to make this point. If you look at what's happened over the last 5 years in the U.S. market, 5 to 6 years, the markets have been a great beneficiary of quantitative easing on the part of our Fed. What we're about to see is quantitative easing in some of these other countries around the world, where the government gets involved and pushes interest rates down. We proved in our market that that works, that will lead to higher prices on investments. I think it will be the same in these international markets. When the governments there start to push interest rates down to buy government bonds, we're going to see those markets move up. I wouldn't have a huge exposure to international. I would still probably rather be in the U.S., but I wouldn't be at zero either. I'd be in that 15 to 20% range.
So has our policy, which is now being adopted in other parts of the world, proven that austerity was the wrong way to go in this recession?
I think it has. I think it tends to be the wrong way to go during recessions. I think the great lesson out of what we've just seen, and I may not live long enough, and you may not live long enough to see this the next time around, but the great lesson is when the government gets involved and wants to drive down interest rates and put money into the system, it works. So when you see that during the next financial crisis, whether that be 10 years or 30 years, don't overthink it. Just look at it as they rang the bell. I need to get into the market.
Okay. That goes in, that flies in the face of a lot of people's political and economical.
It does.
Theories.
But this past 5 or 6 years has convinced me of that.
All right, so let's talk about some end-of-year planning on a personal level here. What should average investors do right now? What should they be doing right now?
Well, nothing dramatic, but we've had a good year in the market. If you've taken gains, I think you certainly need to look at your portfolio and see if you have any place where there's losses that you could take to help offset those gains before year end. I'll give you one that probably some people have, is where they've taken gains, but within their portfolio, they've got a few oil stocks. And all of a sudden, those oil stocks, which had held up real well until the last 30 days, may have gone down 30 or 40% in the last 30 to 60 days. So it's an example where you may want to look and see, should I sell this stock to help offset some of the gains
this
that
is
I've
a
realized?
Principle. This is a principle that a lot of people who may be new to investing have difficulty getting their head around, because you're in the market, you're in investment, you have a portfolio to make money for whatever reason, your retirement, for a college fund, just because you want to go on a nice vacation. You don't want to lose money. So you have gains this year, and that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
And if you've realized those gains, if you've sold those stocks and you have the cash in hand, or you've taken that money and bought other instruments, then you have to pay taxes on that money. So you're talking about finding stocks that are down, that are losing money, selling them at a loss to offset the tax consequences of the gain.
Exactly.
That's really hard to get your head around, because you're losing money on purpose to offset paying taxes.
Is
that really a good thing to do?
Well, it depends. If you think you have some unique knowledge of a particular stock, it may be that you don't want to come out of it, that you don't want to sell and realize the loss. Keeping in mind that if you sell and realize the loss, you need to wait 31 days before you could buy that stock back to avoid the wash sale rules. However, in a lot of cases, a person may have a portfolio where they own Exxon as their big oil company, and they could sell Exxon and buy Chevron, still have basically the same exposure that they've got, but will have booked that loss to offset other gains.
Now, if most of your money is in non-taxable accounts like IRAs and SEPs and 401ks, do you need to do anything aside from, you know, just looking at rebalancing where those investments are?
Yeah, the answer is you don't need to do anything. Given the 2 good years that we've had back-to-back in the market, your comment about rebalancing, I think, is important. In a lot of cases, a person may have a long-term strategy where they're around 60% stocks and 40% bonds or other more conservative investments. With these 2 good years, that 60% in stocks may be up to where it's now 70% in stocks.
Right.
I think you would want to rebalance back to whatever the long-term goal is. I would not look to be overweighted or underweighted, particularly right now. I'd want to be in line with my long-term goals.
You talked about the stock market being up 13% this year. The bond market's coming in around 5%. So if you have a 60-40 mix of stocks to bonds, what should your portfolio be returning right now? Shouldn't be 13%.
No, it probably should be in the 6-8% range. Again, depending on how much risk you have, in a lot of cases right now, for institutions and for individuals, if they're underperforming, they tend to be underperforming more on the bond side because they wanted to avoid the interest rate risk. So they may have gotten 1% or 2% out of that bond piece that's actually up 5% year to date. I wouldn't, overthink that. It doesn't make me want to undo it and go take the interest rate risk. But anytime you look at underperformance, you need to look at where it came from and why.
You know, a lot of people used to say, if you're a newbie to the stock market, you don't want to be buying, and you don't have a lot of money, you don't want to be buying individual stocks. You want to put your money in mutual funds. Then we find out that when you invest in mutual funds, you have no control over when they buy or sell, and people tend to get surprised sometimes by the capital gains on their mutual funds.
Absolutely.
At the end of the year. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, a mutual fund distributes its gains each year, its realized gains. And when they realize a gain and have to pay that out and it goes on your tax return, has nothing to do with when you bought the fund. So you may buy the fund in November and all of a sudden it distributes out 10% of its value as a realized gain in December that's got to go on your tax return this year.
And it has nothing to do with the money you put in.
That's correct.
Money that came previously to the fund.
That's correct. So, one, you need to be aware of it. In a lot of cases, it says you got to be really careful about what you might buy in November or early December. You don't want to pick up that gain unnecessarily. Secondly, you need to pay attention to these funds announce what they're going to distribute, usually 30 days or so in advance. So if you bought a fund and now it's going to distribute out, you can switch into a different fund that's not going to distribute anything and avoid the taxation of that distribution. Next step is once it pays the dividend or the capital gains out, its price per share will adjust down. So it may pay out 10 or 15%, and now you've got a loss on the original shares that you bought when they're priced on a per share basis. So you could move that into a different fund. You've got the taxable gain distribution, but you realize the loss on the primary fund by switching to another fund and are able to offset those two. You just have to pay attention to this. If you go back to 08, 09, and 10, all these funds had losses, and this was not an issue.
Right.
So some newer investors, as you alluded to, are getting introduced to this for the first time, and this will be the first bad year in terms of distributions.
So aside from offsetting those losses, you could also not ever realize offsetting the gains, rather. You could also never realize those gains by only putting mutual funds in non-taxable accounts, correct?
That would work.
Is that a wise thing to do? Should you be doing that? Should average people be doing that only in their non-taxable?
Actually, I'd make a little bit different statement about asset placement.
Okay.
I think that you should put all of your higher income investments inside the IRA. And the investments that are more capital gain oriented outside the IRA. When you have the stocks and stock funds outside, at least when you pick up gains, there'll be long-term capital gains mostly and taxed at a preferential rate. If you have any losses, you have the ability to deduct those losses. But like if you had an REIT or a business development corp that's producing 6 to 10% income, by putting that inside the IRA, you avoid the taxes on that income produced every year.
Right.
And it would be taxed as ordinary income, not as capital gains.
But for people who are relatively young and who may not have a lot of money in an IRA, and you can only put so much money into an IRA every year, they may have excess money to invest. And so they put it in taxable accounts. When you're just starting out and you only have maybe $12,000 because you can only put how much? I don't know how much a young person can put in an IRA. How much can you put in an IRA?
I got that around here somewhere. It's gone up, continues to go up. Keep talking.
We have an hour.
Yeah, we do. I may need it.
Anyway, so you can only put so much in. So if you're 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years into and you've been maxing out your contribution.
$5,500.
Okay, so you got maybe, what, $20,000 in an IRA. But you have excess income and you want to invest that, and you have been investing that in taxable income. Is there a way around this? In that scenario, when you're 25, 30 years old, what should you be doing?
Well, if you think you've got a real tax problem, you probably want to ask the question on any funds that you look at about tax efficiency. But let me take you to something that is related to what we're talking about that I think is widely overlooked from a tax perspective. when you look at the taxation of capital gains, if your income as a single individual is your taxable income, so after deductions and all, is $36,900 or less, or for a joint return, husband and wife, is $73,800 or less. Capital gains and qualifying dividends are taxed at zero.
Wow.
And I think it's widely overlooked that for a lot of people, people early in their career starting out, this is only long-term capital gains and only qualifying dividends, or people that are retired, or people that are, you know, maybe only one spouse works, so their income isn't that high. There's a lot of different ways you could get there, but long-term capital gains are taxed at zero. Qualifying dividends are taxed at zero.
So there's a great way around this.
There is a great way around
it. You just have to know.
You have to pay attention.
Yeah, you have to pay attention. That's what we're learning. That's what I'm learning from this conversation. We've had these conversations many times over the years. But that really a lot of this falls on you. You just can't throw money into the market and be blind about it. You have to really know what you're doing or have somebody who knows what they're doing working for you.
I think that's true, Mike. It's not that hard when you're involved in it a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you're particularly people doing it themselves, which is fine, mm-hmm. They need to spend some time and effort on it.
How many losses can you deduct at tax time to offset your gains?
Yeah, you can use all of your losses to offset gains. If you still have more losses after you've eliminated your gains, you can deduct $3,000 a year, and it carries forward indefinitely. So if I realized $100,000 loss, I had $50,000 of gains, I offset that, I now have $50,000 of loss carry-forwards.
Right.
I deduct $3,000 and carry forward $47,000. Next year, I can use that $47,000 to offset any gains I have the next year. And let's say I had $27,000 of gains in the second year. I offset it. I've got $20,000 left. I deduct $3,000 and carry the $17,000 forward. There are a lot of people that took big losses in 08 or had a bad business venture or whatever, that think they will never live long enough to take advantage of their losses because they can only deduct $3,000 a year. Well, if you create gains, you can work that down pretty well over time.
So if you don't have an accountant, who keeps track of all this?
Whoever does your tax return, it's either your accountant or you that needs to.
Wow. This is also the time of year the charities come calling. We'll talk about that when we come back because there are people who want to give to charities this time of year, and there are people who make substantial philanthropic contributions to charities at this time of year, and you need to know how to do that right. We'll do that when we come back. Larry Carroll is with us, certified financial planner, president, and chief wealth strategist at Carroll Financial Associates, the company that bears his name. I've said that for years. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Nexen Pruitt. 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. And AeroChem Incorporated, a family-owned chemical blender providing chemical solutions to local industry for over 30 years. Information on their product line and contract services at AeroChem.com. Senate Democrats have released a detailed report on post-9/11 CIA interrogation and detention practices. And on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they'll explore the debate over the controversial tactics, what intelligence may have been gathered, and security risks related to the report's release. That's coming up in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation about end-of-year planning, well, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org will get you to us, as will searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
Bob Johnson created Black Entertainment Television, made himself a fortune in the process, and now he wants everybody to have the same opportunity.
If the minority meets the qualifications, They should be given every opportunity to be hired.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, bringing the NFL's Rooney Rule to the office. We will bring you the numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news as well next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, sitting in our Spirit Square studio with Larry Carroll, certified financial planner, who's been on this program and others that I've done over the years for many, many years. And you may have questions about your own personal situation or questions about just general questions about what you should be doing in 2015, looking ahead. You can get to us through Facebook and Twitter and WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us as well. Charities come calling at this time of the year. The phone rings off the hook and people are taking stock. And you also deal with people who make major philanthropic gifts. But it's true, isn't it, that if you make charitable donations in general, this is a good time to do so, right? Because of it's your last chance to do it for tax purposes.
It is, and appreciated stocks, as many people would have after this run-up in the market over the past few years, are a great way to make charitable contributions. Basically, you get the value of the stock that you give as a deduction, and you never have to pay taxes on the gain. So you bought a stock for $50,000. It's now worth $100,000. You contribute the $100,000 worth of stock value, and you never pay taxes on the $50,000 of gain that happened there. So they're a very efficient way to do that. One thing to keep in mind is for that to work, the gain needs to be long-term. You need to have held the investment more than 12 months.
Okay. And that needs to be in a taxable account.
In a taxable account.
So if you're an average person who maybe that $100,000 is their entire nest
right.
egg, can they avail themselves of that on a smaller scale?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've done it for clients and been on the receiving end for some money we manage for charities that that may be $1,000 or $2,000 mm-hmm. contribution. It's pretty easy to do.
And you can do it, I suppose, out of your IRA, but there's no tax advantage of doing that out of your IRA. Well, there's a tax
right.
advantage for the contribution, though, right?
Right. The tax advantage is that money will never come out of the IRA and be taxed. Right. I have a little bit of difficulty thinking of a situation where I would have a client make a $1,000 contribution out of their IRA. You know, it takes some time and effort to get it done that way, but certainly for larger contributions, for people who make a lot of contributions, it's something that can be looked at.
Should normal people be considering this as a way to offset gains?
They certainly should be looking at using appreciated stock for contributions. I think that works for everybody. If they're paying taxes, not everybody does, but if they're paying taxes, I would certainly look at the gifting of appreciated stock.
When you are when all of your investments are in a 401k or they're in an IRA, and it's the time of year when you should be looking at how the stock market has been doing and what you think it's going to do, what process do you go through to rebalance your portfolio?
Well, I think it's just a matter of, one, and a lot of people don't have this understanding, but the first thing is, what long-term allocation am I looking for? I use the example of 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, which is pretty routine allocation for, let's say, someone that's retired and producing a retirement income. What's my long-term allocation target? Then where am I positioned now, and what do I need to do to rebalance or reallocate back to my target? In most cases right now, that would mean taking some money out of stocks and moving it into some non-stock investments within the plan.
Now, of course, when you're rebalancing, you're buying and selling. So
right.
you have to take that into account.
You got to look at
well.
Transaction costs.
Right. And taxes.
And, well, now, I think your original question was that it's all in an IRA.
Okay. Well, 401k IRA, you're correct. That is correct.
Exactly.
So you don't have to concern yourself
with that. You don't have the tax consideration.
Okay. But you do have to look at transaction costs because you may lose money in the transaction.
You do.
Okay. How do you do that without a financial planner or somebody who's an expert at this, knowing, okay, it's going to cost this much to do it. Let's not do that. Let's do this.
I might call the custodian of the plan,
okay,
of your 401k or the IRA, and ask. But in most cases, let's say if it's a 401k, you have no cost of switching investments within the plan. In the vast majority of cases. So that one's pretty easy. If you have your monies that's been rolled into an IRA or something, if you don't know, I'd ask the custodian or the advisor that's attached to the plan, are there any costs associated with it?
Do most of us know enough to ask the right questions?
You know, I hate to generalize, Mike. There are a lot of really smart people out there that do it themselves and are good at it. And there's a lot of people out there that are clueless, and the dangerous combination is when they're clueless and they're trying to do it themselves. But, you know, again, I don't think this is that hard if you spend some time and effort and mental energy on it.
So Gene emails, much of my retirement savings is in traditional IRAs, and I am rapidly approaching the age where I will have to take the required minimum withdrawals. I recently heard about a plan where I could use my traditional IRA funds to purchase an equity-indexed universal life insurance plan and thereby avoid the RMWs. What's an RMW?
Required minimum withdrawal.
Okay. And resulting taxes. I would receive a check from the insurance company to pay the taxes owed on my IRA money. The check would be considered a loan at 4% interest to be applied against the death benefit at my death. My heirs would receive a tax-free death benefit. There would be no taxes owed on money I withdraw during my lifetime, and there is no required minimum withdrawal each year. Are you familiar with this type of investment strategy, and what's your opinion of it? I've never heard of that. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'm marginally familiar with it. I look at it as kind of a big game people are trying to play. I won't say it won't work. I would say that you may have issues if you need to access a lot more money than just the required withdrawal amount. You've got some risk as to the insurance company, although I think that's pretty small. I think you're putting yourself in a long-term box and things are subject to change. If a person looked at it, I might look at it for a piece of the money, but the whole gimmick approach to it doesn't particularly appeal to me.
Okay. Let's talk about minimum withdrawals, because if you're past 70 and a half and you have an IRA, you have to start taking minimum distributions from that account. There are penalties if you don't. What are those penalties?
The penalty for not taking out what you should is 50% of the amount
that you should have taken out.
Wow.
That's a penalty.
It's the biggest penalty I'm aware of in the tax code. But generally, whoever is the custodian of the IRA, mm-hmm. whether it's a major brokerage firm or insurance company, whomever you're dealing with that handles the IRA, because of the penalty being so onerous, they're going to make sure that you get the distribution
out. What is the minimum distribution?
Yeah.
Is it prorated upon how much money you have in the account? How does it work?
Yeah, it's based on how much money you've got in the account and your remaining life expectancy. So the first year, it's going to be approximately 3.9% of the value of the account. The next year, you're going to do a new calculation based on the new value of the account and your remaining life expectancy, which is shorter now. So the percentage goes up each year as you get older because your remaining life expectancy is shorter. The value of the account may go up or down during the year based on what you're invested in. So the percentage goes up every year. The amount that you have to take each year may or may not go up. Mm-hmm. But when you get into, you know, your 80s, you're looking at having to take 7 or 8% of the value of the account a year, and it will continue to go up over time.
Most people have not saved a lot for retirement. That's what we keep reading about in the press. So this is going to, the number is going to change over time because inflation someday will kick back in. How much money should you be? How much money should you have at retirement to live, to continue your life, or should you expect to be able to continue your life in the way, in the style you're able to live it while you're employed?
Yeah, it kind of depends on how much you're accustomed to spending, but let me walk through it this way. If you're retiring at, let's say, 65, pretty normal age, you're going to begin to take money from your IRA and 401k and other savings to support your lifestyle. You basically need to determine how much in total do I need, subtract from that what you would get from Social Security, which will pay part of that need. You need to get the remainder of the need from your accumulated funds. We would want the amount that you withdraw from your accumulated funds to be in the 4 to 4.5% range. If it's in the 4 and 4.5% range, two things I can tell you. There's never been a 30-year period, and at 65, we need to be planning on 30 years of retirement. There's never been a 30-year period when you would run out of money. And secondly, that assumes increasing the withdrawal rate for inflation each year for that 30-year period.
At an inflation rate of?
Well, if you were just running it blind, you'd run it at 3.
Okay.
But when you do this back testing of these calculations, they use the actual inflation rates that took place during those periods.
Okay.
But long-term trend number is 3%.
Now, Social Security. People who retire early can take it at, what, 62?
Yes.
They recommend taking it at, what, 67, 66?
66, 67, depending on when you were born, is kind of full retirement age.
And I've heard two arguments. I heard somebody at a seminar that I went to about this say that if you can take it at 62, take it, because you will be taking it for four to five years longer than you normally would. So even though your payout each month is going to be less than it would be if you'd waited longer, you're going to get more money over time because you've taken it out for those 4 or 5 years. Other people say wait as long as you can because it goes up every year that you wait. Where do you fall on this?
Yeah, we would tell most people that if they can, to wait till 70 to take Social Security, which is when you get the highest number that they will pay. Here's why. You know, people look at it at 62 in terms of, as you said, the amount that I can get out over what period of time. Mm-hmm. And they think of it in terms of, well, gee, I may die early. And if I wait, I may not have gotten as much out.
Or any.
Or any. Well, you know, for most people that you do a retirement calculation on, if they die early, they have enough money. Your risk is not dying early. Your risk is that you live to 95.
Right.
And if you wait till 70, you will have locked into a much larger number for your monthly check. You'll get the cost of living increases on a much larger number. And it provides a safety net or an insurance policy against the idea of living too long. Now, if it's a married couple, particularly where both may have qualified for Social Security, we would look at the idea of one of them waiting till 70.
The lower income person, right?
Usually the higher income person, the one that gets the biggest benefit.
Right. Okay.
We would look at that person waiting till 70. And then for the spouse with the lower benefit, we may take that early, or we may take that as soon as they hit 66. But to try to maximize the high number for the long time.
Let's talk about Roth IRAs. Not everybody can have them because they don't qualify, but a lot of people are concerned about saving all this money in a traditional IRA, which has tax consequences when you withdraw it, and taxes may actually go up for some people in retirement. So is it better, if you can, to put the money in a Roth where you pay the money on the taxes going in and never coming out?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. It's all about tax brackets. For a young person who is early in their career, does not have a big income at this point, but has reason to believe that they may have a good income as their career progresses, the Roth IRA works because they don't get any deduction now, but they're in a moderate to low tax bracket now. Mm-hmm. If their career goes as they plan, they could be in a much higher tax bracket later at the end of their career when they would be bringing it out. So the idea of not deducting it in a low bracket but not having to pay income later when you're in a higher bracket works very well. But it's all about predicting what brackets you plan to be in now mm-hmm. and at later points in time in your life.
A couple of articles that you're recommending that people read, you call them must-read articles, teaching your kids or grandkids about money. Where would we find that article?
I think it's posted on our website,
okay.
Mike.
And the Four Stages of Retirement, which is in the Charlotte Observer Special Edition.
It's a group of articles my son and I wrote. They're on our website also.
Okay, and being prepared for an emergency, the Family Love Letter, also on your website. Which would be?
It's the idea of leaving information for your heirs right. to help them sort through your stuff. Particularly important now when everybody's got so many passwords and different things that aren't recorded anywhere.
And your website is?
CarrollFinancial.com.
And that's where you will find information about the must-read articles and also about him. Larry Carroll, financial planner, thank you for
Thanks,
the hour.
Mike.
I appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks with